Well, what have we decided? Is this lecture S18 on December 3rd?
Lecture S18, December 3rd, 1962, the Maxwell equations. Lecture S18, December 3rd, 1962, the Maxwell equations. Lecture S18, December 3rd, 1962, the Maxwell equations. Lecture S18, December 3rd, 1962, the Maxwell equations.
I begin today's lecture. I would like to tag something on the end of the last lecture that I didn't get to. And that, of course, will push something in this lecture onto the next one and so on. But I'll do it anyway. It's because it's a rather important rule. The energy we know in the magnetic field there, when there are steady currents, is the integral of J dot A. That was in the lecture last time, but I wanted to give another form for the same thing, which I didn't get to. Since for steady currents, the curl of B is equal to J over epsilon naught C square, this can also be written in terms of B and A. Now, if you look at it, you might hope that you could express it entirely in terms of B because you have derivatives on the A, but of course, unfortunately, the derivatives are on the B. However, let's look at a typical term of this thing expanding. Well, it turns out this is equal to epsilon naught C squared over 2 times the integral of B dot curl A times d volume. That is that the curl can be swung around. Now, the reason for that, I'll show in just this moment here. Suppose we take a typical term out of here and say the z component of the curl begins with a derivative with respect to x of by, and then it'll be, since the z component, az. And there'll be six other terms of this general type. But let's look at one of these terms. We have to integrate with respect to x and with respect to y and z, which will hold for the end of the thinking. Here we have an integral with respect to x, of course, y and z later, but let's keep y and z fixed and integrate with respect to x. This is an integral that can be done by parts. We can get by times az minus sign, and then plus the integral of by times, no, not plus, that's mixed up. It's plus over here and it's minus over here. For by integrating by the x by parts, we get to here. Now, supposing that the system is finite, that as we go to infinity, the fields all disappear. Under those circumstances, since we need this at the limits of x, which is plus or minus infinity, this will be 0. So if the currents that are generated in the fields are limited in space, then this term is 0. And then we have converted our different derivatives onto A. And then, of course, we have dx, and we can put back the dy dz, which gives us back a volume integral. And so it turns out that every derivative on B can be converted to a derivative on A. And if you just go through the six terms and convert them, and then look back to find out whether these combinations of derivatives of something else in vector analysis, sure enough, they're B dot curl A. The importance of this is that curl A is equal to B. So it's B dot B. So the energy can also be given by the integral of the square of the magnetic field times epsilon naught C squared over 2, a formula that's analogous to the formula for electric energy, which is epsilon naught over 2 times the integral of E squared over the volume. The reason for emphasizing this is, first, that it's another formula that helps, sometimes easier to use, sometimes the other way around, than this one. But most important is this. It turns out that in a dynamic case, when things are not steady currents, this formula for energy is incorrect, while this one happens to be correct. So I might as well introduce you to the right answer, and that's the end of yesterday's lecture. Okay. Today we begin a lecture on Maxwell's equations, which is to bring us back to the beginning, or the first lecture of the course. The point is that we have been, in fact, studying Maxwell's equations in bits and pieces. And today we have to put all the pieces back together again, add another piece that we haven't mentioned yet, and see what we get. Today's lecture supersedes all previous lectures. Anything said today which contradicts something said earlier is true, and that which was said earlier is false. Because what was said earlier applied, say, to steady currents, to fixed charges, and although I've been very careful to say this every time when I wrote an equation that this is for steady currents, for instance, when I was making this derivation, I said, for steady currents. You don't hear that. And so you learn a wrong equation. So remember, if they differ, from now on, the truth is coming. And that what was before was an approximation or a special case under certain circumstances only, such as fixed current. Now, here are the Maxwell equations. I've written them down as equations, and for those who can't read equations yet, I've written them in words. The fact that the words are equivalent to the equations should, by this time, be familiar. You should be able to read back and forth from one to the other. Incidentally, I would suggest, if you have some time to review the electricity that you've learned so far, that you review it with these equations in mind, noticing at every point in where there's a term missing on the review, so that you don't overemphasize or overlearn those things which aren't exactly true. For example, that the curl E is zero. Remember, that's only in a steady case and so on, all right? So when you review, please pay attention to this list so that you know while you're reviewing what it is, what applies to circumstances which are not general. Well, the one equation which is general is that the divergence of E is the charge over epsilon naught, which we sometimes call Gauss's law. That holds up, that the flux of E through any closed surface is proportional to the charge inside the surface. And now we have also the law for magnetic fields, that the flux of B through any closed surface is always zero. In addition, Faraday's law, which was recently learned, is correct as it stands and will not be altered. That is that the curl of E is minus dB dt, that the flux of the B changing produces a E in integration around a circuit. Finally, however, we have one more that we've been using, which is only valid for steady currents and which has to be corrected today. And that is that the curl of B is J over epsilon naught C squared. It was only valid for steady currents. There's an additional term, dE dt. This term was discovered by Maxwell. What Maxwell did was to take the known laws of electricity, including Faraday's law, and express them in a mathematical form, which you now see here. He used somewhat different notation. But as a matter of fact, it's mainly due to Maxwell that the importance of the combinations of derivatives, which we call today the curl and the divergence, first became apparent. At any rate, he wrote them down and got up to here. But as I think we already pointed out, the divergence of B of this side, being a curl, will be zero. And therefore, this equation, without the following term here, which was discovered by Maxwell, would have to require that the divergence of J is zero. But what is the divergence of J? That's the amount of current which leaves a unit volume by flowing out. Or, in integral form, the integral of divergence of J would be the integral of the normal component of J over a surface. That's the integral of the divergence of J over a volume. And let's see what it means to say that the integral of the normal component of the current over any closed surface is zero. That means that no net current is leaving a surface. That, in general, is false. It's possible for charges inside of a box to come out through the walls of the box. So this isn't equal to zero, but in general is equal to the rate of change with time of the charge inside of the surface. Minus, because as the charge flows out. In fact, that's what a current, this is one of the best definitions of J anyway. I've written that in differential form. The divergence of J is minus the rate of change of the charge per unit volume with respect to time. That's the conservation of charge. Charge is never lost, this says. But it doesn't say that the divergence of J is equal to zero. Well, Maxwell appreciated, therefore, there must be another term over here. How he obtained that other term, what the right form was and so on, we needn't bother to follow. I'll tell you how he did, though. He made a mechanical model which would produce as many of the equations as possible and discovered, of course, since a mechanical model has to be self-consistent, he can't produce inconsistent equations, that this equation wasn't produced, but it had another term hanging on. So he was very impressed with the mechanical model, and that made a great deal of difficulty for people to accept the theory, because the mechanical model was quite peculiar and the origin of this term quite odd. Nevertheless, the only thing we realize today that counts is the equations themselves and not the mechanical model. So we take all the scaffolding away and leave the beautiful edifice there, although Maxwell tried to sell it with the scaffolding all intact. That caused a certain amount of resistance for several years. However, with the scaffolding removed, there's an extra term here. Now I'd like to first show that the extra term is just what's required to straighten out the fact that the divergence of this side is automatically and exactly zero. So let's check it mathematically. Let's take the divergence of the last equation. We get on that side zero, that's the whole problem. On the other side, we have the divergence of J over epsilon naught, which used to be zero. But now we have a new term, which is the divergence of ddt of E. Now you can differentiate with respect to time or space first, doesn't make any difference. The divergence of ddt is the ddt of the divergence of E. But another one of Maxwell's equations says that the divergence of E is rho over epsilon zero. How nice. Here is rho over epsilon zero. Epsilon zero is a constant. And so divergence J plus d rho dt it is that has to be zero. But that is zero. That's the conservation of charge. Therefore, it must impress you or this, that you cannot answer a question. Suppose that suddenly there's no charge here, and suddenly a charge was created at this point. What electromagnetic effects are produced? Nobody knows. The equations of Maxwell are only consistent in circumstances in which the current and charge satisfy the conservation law. If I suppose a charge is suddenly created at a point, I have no equations that I know of by which I can calculate what the effects are going to be. If I say instead, oh, you got that charge from somewhere else, you had a charge over there, carried it in a wire and put it here, that's fine. I took the charge away from there, I put it here and made a current. Then the equations are consistent again. Of course, if the charge is not created from nowhere, so that's an interesting point. That comes up never in practice, because in practice, of course, there's always have conserved charges, because of the way nature fortunately seems to work. Well, maybe not. If nature didn't work that way, we'd find the right equations for non-conserved charges. Anyway, these are all we've got. When we added a new term each time to the equation, we went to a lot of trouble, in fact, several lectures, for instance, in the case of Faraday's law, to describe very carefully what this term alone did. And so you'd expect now we have several lectures on the effect of this term. However, instead of several lectures, because it's getting boring doing each term in the equation so long, and also because this term by itself doesn't do much, it turns out, except to straighten out the other equation from time to the steady current equation in certain circumstances. So I'll take just two examples to illustrate how it works sometimes. It's two examples. First example, we have a little sphere with radioactive material in it or on it. And these radioactive material is squirting out alpha particles or charged particles which are going out. Or if you want, you can have a jello and insert a charge in the center of it with a hypodermic needle and let the charge leak out. In other words, we have a spherically outgoing current. Let's make it very definite, however. Yes, well, it doesn't have to be definite. There's a current going out, which we'll suppose is spherically symmetrical, and there's a charge inside, say here, which we'll suppose is changing, of course, because the current is going out. Incidentally, the conservation of current says that the strength of the current times 4 pi r square, if r is any radius at all, is equal to the rate of change of the total charge inside. Just practice. All right? Just so you know what currents are and how it works. Now the problem is, what is the magnetic field produced under these circumstances? Look, let's take a little region right here. There's current coming at me, okay? So I draw one of those nice loops, and I say the integral around the closed loop of B is equal to the current through the loop. So there's current through, so there must be a B going around this way. Now go ahead, figure out how to do that all around on a sphere. If the B has to be up this way and down this way, no, it can't be up this way and down this way. Which way is up? It's a sphere. The only possible, well, due to symmetry, the B is clearly zero or else it's radial. And this says, however, that the tangential component of B must none be zero so that the integral around the closed circuit can equal the J coming through. Trouble. Saved. Because there's an electric field term in the equation, too. The line integral of the B around the closed ring is equal to the current through plus plus, the rate of change with time of the electric flux through. That's the flux of electric field. Now, why is there an electric field? Well, there's a charge inside, so there's an electric field. And why is it changing? Because the charge inside is changing. The electric field is falling. Let's find out how much dE dt is everywhere. That's easy. The electric field at a radius r is the total charge over 4 pi epsilon naught r squared. I didn't think you'd see that one again. That's where we began. Now, at a given place. Now, it changes with time. We want to find the change with time. Okay, that's 1 over 4 pi r squared epsilon 0 times dq dt. But lo, the current. Well, all right, the current is 1 over 4 pi r squared dq dt. Oh, it's minus. So you see the current and the dE dt terms exactly cancel, especially after I divide the current by epsilon naught. And it tells me that the curl of B can be chosen 0, is equal to 0, not equal to the current. And that's good, because there's no magnetic field in this case. Here we have an example of a current that produces no field. Spherical current will produce no field. Example, notice that this difference between this situation and the situations previously discussed is that this is not a steady condition. This current can't go on forever. Pretty soon we have rid of the charge. The current isn't just circulating around, but it's building up charge or taking charge away from somewhere. Under those circumstances, we need the extra term. Case two. We have a wire that's running into a pair of plates like a condenser plates. Parallel plates and so on, you know? Just like the picture. And there's a certain amount of current coming in. Now we know that the line integral of the magnetic field around here, in fact, we know that the magnetic field should be here, it should be equal to the current divided by 2 pi. I don't know whether it's a 2 pi or not. I forget. R epsilon naught. Yeah, I guess that's right. There's a magnetic field that goes around the wire. Okay, far away from this thing, the magnetic field's going around the wire, going around here. On the other hand, suppose that we took a plane right through here and took the magnetic field to find the magnetic field out here, far away. Then we'd say, all right, we have to integrate the magnetic field around. And the integral of the magnetic field around a closed circuit is equal to the current through the surface. But there is no current through the surface. Ha, ha, ha. There's just positive charge building up here and negative charge building up there. And there's no current through the surface. Therefore, the magnetic field is zero here. Marvelous effect. You have a very fine condenser with long wires feeding it. And that means that the magnetic field over there is something. But the moment you get exactly in line with the plates, it goes to zero. So I can make signals by turning the plates, you know, beep, 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 beep. And furthermore, it didn't say anything about the surface having to be plane. Or suppose that the condenser is like that. Then what do you do? And furthermore, what happens if you take instead of the surface that has the same loop on the edge, but take this surface, then there is a current through. So you get different answers depending on which surface. Horrible. All saved by the following term, the dE dt term. In the region out here, there isn't much change in electric field. There's practically no electric field and no change. But in the condenser, there is an electric field. In fact, an electric field which is equal to charge density on the plates divided by epsilon naught. Now, is the charge density on the plates changing? Ha-ha, yes, because there's a current flowing in. So since there's a current flowing in, the sigma, the area, the surface current is changing, and the dE dt is equal to the rate of change of sigma with time times 1 over epsilon naught. Now, if we take this formula, the line integral of B around this loop should equal the total current flowing through the loop, 0, plus the total flux of electric field through the loop. Well, I should have calculated the flux first. Here's the electric field, and the flux of the electric field is the electric field times the area, which is equal to sigma A over epsilon naught. In fact, it's the total charge on a conductor over epsilon naught. That's the electric flux. So the rate of change of the electric flux with respect to time is equal to Q dot, or the rate of change of Q with respect to time, times 1 over epsilon naught. Now, what's the rate of change of Q? It's the current. The rate of change of the charge is the current that's flowing in. See, so that the equation cheats you out of this wonderful paradox. When you have the surface through here, it makes a flux of electric field, which is exactly equal to the current that's flowing into the wire, through the wire, to such a way, in such a manner that the line integral of B around this loop is the same whether the surface goes through here or through there, and is exactly the same whether this loop is here or here. And this wonderful invention of making signals by wiggling the plates of a condenser won't work. And furthermore, there is no paradoxes or difficulties produced by condenser plates that look like this. The field produced outside, sufficiently far away from this, is practically the same whether there are condensers, open circuits, or not. Okay, so that's what this term does, and that's all we're going to say about it. But don't forget it. It's there. Otherwise, you get crazy answers and silly effects. It by itself doesn't produce a great deal of interesting things. I say it by itself. Faraday's law, all by itself, you can understand an awful lot of wonderful effects. But this law by itself doesn't seem to produce particularly much. However, there's a sudden change when we say, when we remove the words by itself. Put these things together, and then something wonderful happens. Before I do it, though, I'd like to summarize all that is known, or all that was known of fundamental classical physics up to 1924. Well, up till now, I said classical physics. The quantum mechanics straightened this out. But this is all that's known. Except for the law of gravity, which you can write down right away, that the force is equal to the masses times the masses over the square of the distance. Okay, now I got that. I should have put on this board. But anyway, here are the Maxwell equations. And they're written in a very expanded form here. So I'm not trying to save space, even. Here's the conservation of charge, which is even written in parentheses. Because the moment I have the Maxwell equations, I can deduce the conservation of charge. But that's a minor matter. So I'm even being a little redundant. Then I write the force law, because after all, having all the electric and magnetic fields doesn't tell me anything until I know what it does to things. And so given the E and the B, I can find the force on an object moving with velocity V by this law, where Q is the charge. Now, having the force doesn't tell me anything until I know what happens when a force is pushed on something. And so we have the Newtonian law that the force is the rate of change of the momentum. Remember that? Yeah. And you know what the momentum is? It's the mass at rest times the velocity divided by the square root of 1 minus v squared over c squared, where v is the velocity of the object. That's all that we of the fundamental physical laws. And they're all on one black of classical physics. They're all on one blackboard with the exception of the law of gravitation. And in a redundant and expanded fashion. I mean, after all, if you knew what the symbols meant, you could only have to write this stuff, this one. And this one can be put in one equation to make it look nice. All right. So there we are. That's a great moment. We have climbed a great peak. We are on the top of K2. The Everest is the quantum mechanics. And we're going over the pass. Whether we're going from China to India or from India to China, we leave to you to decide. It's your choice. However, we've climbed up the pass, and now we go down the other side. In short, we've been trying to learn what the equations meant, and now we're going to find out, after we've got the whole thing put together and know what they mean, what things they say that we haven't already studied, what new things they say that we haven't already studied and trying to understand putting them together. We've been creeping up to this thing, and it's been a great effort, and now we're going to have nice sailing downhill to see the consequences. I mean, from a mathematical standpoint, downhill. Now for the consequences. They come from the combination of these equations, the electric equations particularly, the mechanical ones we studied ad nauseum. Of the new terms just added and the old ones. Let's try to find out what would happen in a circumstance, which I've invented to be particularly simple, which is one-dimensional, so that all of the equations have only things varying in one direction. We'll suppose that there's a sheet of charge density, which is at first at rest, and then is instantaneously given a velocity v. You may worry about that, but it doesn't make any difference. You can work out a harder problem where it's slowed up, where it's speeded up, but we'll take a case. It's suddenly given a velocity v, so there suddenly appears a current j. Or to keep it simple, suppose that there's also a background of opposite sign of charge, so I get rid of the electrostatic effects. In other words, all I want is a situation where there's no current, then I have a sheet, and all of a sudden I put current in the sheet, okay? J is in the sheet. The sheet is very thin. Say delta is the thickness, so there's a certain current in a sheet. What should happen? Well, when there's a current in a sheet, as we know, there's a magnetic field generator which will be up here and down here, so that the line integral of the magnetic field will equal the current. I think that that means that the magnetic field times 2 times the length of an imaginary thing is equal to the current times delta times L over epsilon naught c squared. It doesn't make any difference. There's a certain magnetic field produced by the current. Okay, and where is that magnetic field? Well, if this is an infinite sheet, we would expect the magnetic field to be out here, further and further, everywhere. That means that the moment I turned on the current at the point here, for example, the magnetic field has suddenly changed from 0 to a finite value. That ain't so good. If the magnetic field has suddenly changed, there should be or changed in any way, in fact, there should be tremendous electrical effects. If it's suddenly changed or changed in any way, there's electrical effects. I move this, I'm supposed to get a magnetic field here. That means there must be electric fields generated when I turned it on. But if there are electric fields generated, they have to change from 0 to something. And they have to change from 0 to something, and they contribute beside the current J some other corrections to the magnetic field that I got, see? So through the various equations, there's a big intermesh, and we have to resolve the problem. I'm going to tell you what the solution is, and then show you that there is a solution. But it's not easy directly, by looking at the equations and physical argument alone, to directly see that this is, in fact, the solution of these equations directly. But I'll show you what the answer is, and we'll verify it. The answer is the following: that the field B that we talked about here is, in fact, generated right near here. It must be, because in this tiny loop, there's no room for any electric field terms, because I have all the currents so concentrated in such a thin layer. But that the field out here at a finite distance is not this at first, but is 0, stays 0, because it doesn't change. But it waits a while, and then it suddenly turns on. In short, we turn on the current, the field immediately next to it turns on, the B. But the turning on of B everywhere spreads out from the region. So let me look immediately then at the solution. I had drawn it in beautiful technicolor, how it's supposed to look. This blue thing is the sheet where the current is generated, and J is the vector current with the sheet of thickness J. At t equals 0, we turn on the current suddenly. Before t equals 0, the field is 0 everywhere. The fields, both fields B and E, are 0 also at a distance far enough away. What happens is that the influence of this current makes its way progressively at a uniform velocity, which turns out to be c. But for a while, we'll suppose the velocity had some other number, v. What happens is that the fields that are generated move out in a uniform velocity, say v. And so there is a delay before the region out here finds out that the current was turned on. Let's find out how the fields look. I drew a picture in three dimensions so you can get some appreciation of the geometry. What happens is that when you move this, you get the magnetic fields that are required by the steady current case. That these magnetic fields exist in the steady current case to infinity. But in the dynamic situation, in which the thing has only been turned on for a finite time, they only exist out to a distance equal to c times t. There are also electric fields. There must be electric fields because there are changing magnetic fields. Now, I was to emphasize that this is supposed to be infinite in both directions perpendicular to this line. It only varies in that direction. I can't draw an infinite sheet so you could see anything, so I do a finite one. Now, in order to analyze what happens, I take two views of this thing, one looking down. And you're looking down, and here's that sheet coming up at you, like so. And there's magnetic field in this direction. And that is a picture of the thing. A situation from the side, well, which one is, it doesn't make any difference which one I start with. So let's start with the top view. No, we have, I'd rather start with the side view. Excuse me. Now we take a side view. Here we see the sheet moving up, the magnetic field into the board here, and out of the board here, as drawn over there. Going into the board, and nothing out here. How can that be consistent with the equation? Let us draw one of those line things, that we, loops that we use to calculate a line integral, supposing that the height of the loop is L, and see if the, what the electric field has to be. Because you see, in this fixed coil here, if this front surface where B exists is moving forward at a velocity V, unknown to be found, then the flux of B through here, through this loop, is increasing. Why? The B is constant. But the area in which B exists is progressively increasing at a velocity, in fact, V. How fast is the magnetic flux changing? By Faraday's law, the curl of the electric field must, the circulation integral of the electric field must be the rate of change of the flux. The flux is the amount of B times the area. The rate of change of the flux, since the B is constant, is the amount of B times the rate of change of the area. The rate of change of the area is easy. In a moment, delta T, this L will move here. And so you'll get V delta T L. That is, the line integral of V must be the rate of change of the flux of B. And the rate of change of the flux of B is B times L times V, where V is the speed at which the front edge of the region where field is moving. On the other hand, this line integral must equal the must be the line integral of E. And I've drawn up with the right sign and everything. I've drawn a picture where I suppose there's an electric field here, so there will be a line integral. There's no electric field here. Any electric field of vertical would cancel out, so it must be up and down here. So there must be an electric field associated with it, given this way. And the electric field in size is equal to V times B, therefore, and that would solve the equations all right. So if there's an electric field in here too, beside the B, then we can get the equation solved. On the other hand, well, that's not the only equation. We have the other equation that the curl of B must be dE dt plus J. In order to understand that circumstance, I look down on the picture, and I have this picture. Now I have an electric field going down through here. The line integral of B is equal in general to the current plus the rate of change of electric flux. That's the new term. So we add this term, the rate of change of electric flux. The current in this particular loop here is zero because all the current's over here. And therefore, by using the same argument as before, the line integral of B, this time we know what the B is. It's B here and it's zero here and so on. So it's just B times L. It's 1 over C squared times the line integral of B. So it's B times L over C squared, which is the rate of change of the flux of E. And by the same argument as previously, that's E times L times V. From which we conclude that 1 over C squared B equal VE. And therefore, we have a solution in which we have a constant B and a constant E inside, both at right angles to the direction in which the thing is moving out, such that E is V times B. Oh, but you can't have everything at the same time. And that B is C squared V. That's something went upside down. Yeah, it's C squared times the line integral if you look over somewhere. It ought to be anyway. Yeah, C squared times the line integral. So it's C squared B is equal to VE. But E is VB. So VE from the other equation is V squared B. And V squared equals C squared, or V equals C. In other words, the electrical disturbance, the effects of the electrical disturbance, travel out at a velocity equal to C. And incidentally, they travel in both directions in this particular problem, and I've drawn it from both sides. Here's an example, at any rate, in which the electrical influence from a current propagates at a certain finite velocity equal to C. Let me go on a moment and ask, what happens if I suddenly stop the current? Oh, gosh, we have to analyze all over again another problem. Wait. By the principle of superposition, let's be clever about the thing, huh? We have the current, zero, suddenly turned on, have the solution here. Now we're going to add another solution, which is that there's another current, which is zero, and suddenly turned on, only later, right? Then what happens to the total current? The total current of those two added together, zero, turned on, turned off. Effect the same as current turned on, other current turned on, going the other way. Clear that the current turned on going the other way produces all the fields with the signs reversed. And, of course, delay, everything is timed later by the delay time. What happens then is that we must add to this solution, this block of field marching out, another solution with a block of field reversed marching out behind it at the same velocity with exactly the same fields but opposite in sign. In other words, nothing. In short, we have a little piece of fields which are held in a block which have left the current, which travel through space all by themselves, which have disappeared, which have no longer connected to the source, which propagate alone, have become free. The caterpillar has turned into a butterfly. These things that you crawled up to find about, we suddenly find ourselves flying through space, separated from the charges which produced us. How can this bundle of electric and magnetic field maintain itself? By the combination of the two laws, this Faraday's law and the new law here, they cannot help but maintain themselves. Why? You want the magnetic field to disappear? You do? Then you'll have a changing magnetic field. So you've got to get an electric field. Okay, I'll have an electric field. Now I want the electric field to disappear. Why not? Ha! Then you have a changing electric field. Then you create a magnetic field. And so by the perpetual balance or the squishing back and forth between one field and the other, it's impossible for them to disappear. And so they maintain themselves in a kind of a dance, one making the other, waking the other, making the one, and so on, propagating everywhere through space. When I make a current, I make a magnetic field. The increasing magnetic field makes an electric field. The increasing electric field makes a magnetic field, which makes and so we have waves which leave the material at a velocity equal to C. What was C? C is the speed of light. Wait. From a historical point of view, the C wasn't exactly known to be the speed that light propagates. That is, you see, when I teach the subject, I like in the beginning to call the things what they are, so you don't have to learn several things. I could have carried this around, this C square, and never told you what it was, that it was the speed of light, but just said that we have to determine it numerically by electrical measurements. What do you mean? I mean, before we have this term here, in the electrostatics and in electrodynamics, the C square appears because we can ask for force between two charges that determines this constant epsilon naught. And the force between two currents, that involves the combination epsilon naught C square. So if I measure the force between two currents and the force between two charges and take a ratio, no measuring no light, you know, I'm just measuring forces between wires carrying currents and between charges and take a ratio, I can determine this quantity C squared electrically alone. You say, yeah, but how did you know that you got the units of current right? Doesn't it depend on the units of current? Well, no. Once I make up my mind what the units of charge are, and that's what that dirty epsilon zero is doing in here, anybody can use anything for epsilon zero, because that just involves the units of charge. Once I determine the units of charge, the units of current are so and so much charge per second goes through the wire. I can pile the charge up on a condenser and measure it by the forces generated in an hour of charging. So the current's unit is not independent of the charge unit, and so with the corresponding unit of current, I can find out how strong are the forces between two wires, and thus determine this ratio C. In the old days, this was called measuring the ratio of the electrostatic and the electromagnetic units, because when the equations were first written down, they hadn't done this experiment of comparing the two, you see. They didn't get the units of current at first compared with the units of charge carefully. But when they did it, they discovered that the C involved in this formula is about 3.15 times 10 to the 8th meters per second. And there was noticed that this is very close, accidentally perhaps, to the speed of light, and it was a great mystery. When Maxwell finished his equations and then found out, like we have just found out, that the effects are propagated with a velocity equal to that C, he could say, of course, that bundles of electric and magnetic fields propagate at a speed which we have measured electrically from previous measurements of 3 or so times 10 to the 8th. But that's the same as the speed at which light may propagate. We can scarcely avoid the inference, said Maxwell, that light consists in the transverse undulations of the same medium, which is a cause of electric and magnetic phenomena. This was one of the great unifications of physics, because there was light and there was electricity and magnetism. They were unified experimentally through Faraday and Oersted, electricity and magnetism. But all of a sudden, light was no longer something else. It was only electricity and magnetism in this new form, this little piece, these bundle of electrical and magnetic fields, which propagate on its own, in its own right, in their own right. I have called your attention to something which, although it appears only in this special solution, turns out to be general so that you can remember. And that is, you'll notice that the magnetic field is perpendicular to the direction of motion, and that the electric field is likewise perpendicular to the direction of motion of the waves. And they are perpendicular to each other. And furthermore, the electric field is equal to C times the magnetic field in the wave. And those three facts, that the two fields are transverse to the direction of propagation, and that the electric field is equal to C times the magnetic field, are completely general and do not take only this case. This special case is a good case. It tells all about electromagnetic waves. It's just as a plane wave that came out instead of some kind of complicated spherical distribution. Now, at the end of this lecture, I would like to do something mathematical. I want to solve Maxwell's equations, or rather, I want to simplify Maxwell's equations. You may consider it complicating them, but if you'll be patient a little bit, they will suddenly come out simpler. Because, although by this time you're thoroughly used to these horrible equations, many people have said they're beautiful. I don't find them particularly beautiful. There are pieces all over that's complicated. Watch. We're going to solve them. Now look. Start here. The divergence of B is zero. That something of B is a vector which has zero divergence, and we know that that implies that the B is the curl of something. So if we write this, we've already solved one of Maxwell's equations. Incidentally, you appreciate that already that another vector would be just as good if we added a pure gradient to representing the magnetic field B, because the curl of this extra gradient is zero, and it makes no difference. We talked about that before. That's not an important part. This commentary about what you can do to the A is not an essential to the matter, so don't pay too much attention. Concentrate on the next stages of the equations. The next equation I'm going to take is the Faraday law, because it doesn't involve any currents and charges. Well, never mind the because. The next equation I'm going to take is the Faraday law. It says that the curl of E is minus dB dt. So I'll differentiate this thing, and since I can either differentiate with respect to time or space first, makes no difference. There's Faraday's law. Oh, but that means that the curl of E plus dA dt is equal to 0. Now we solve that one. The curl of a certain vector is equal to 0. Therefore, that vector is the gradient of something. We used to have no Faraday's law, and we had curl E equals 0, and then we decided that E itself was the gradient of something, and we took it to be minus the gradient of something just for technical reasons. We wanted to call it the same thing again, so that in the electrostatic case, where nothing changes with time and this term disappears, the E will be our old minus gradient phi. So the next equation is that the electric field is equal to minus gradient phi, as it always was, except because of Faraday's law, there are new current, new fields or corrections to the field, which is given by the rate of change of A with respect to T. Lo, we have solved two of Maxwell's equations already. And we have, to describe the electromagnetic field, four potentials, or rather, a scalar potential, phi, and a vector having three components, A. That's four functions. It is desirable, one of the points we'd like to make is that you can change the A without changing the fields. And if I change the A, this is a side remark again, if I change the A by adding chi, I don't change B. This is just for experts who worry about these matters. But I want not to change E either. I want the physics to remain the same. But if I change the A, I'll change this term. And so I change the electric field. Something is the matter. No, wait. How much do I change this term? I change it by the gradient of d chi dt. That is by the gradient of something. Oh, if I also change phi concomitantly, if that's the right word, with A by minus, I believe. If I make the following changes, if somebody has an A and a phi and solve the problem, I come along and I use a different A and a phi in which the A adds a gradient and the phi adds a time derivative of the same function chi, then it'll make the same field, see? So everything's all right. I just had to make a little expansion of the rules for this thing. That's it. This freedom, however, permits us to make a choice on some one function, because we have one free function, chi, in these things. Previously, we chose to make the divergence of A equal to 0. I use that freedom to choose that to make the equations easier. We are not going to do that now. We're going to do something else. I think the best thing to do to illustrate why we do that something else is to find out what happens if we just wait till later to make our choice. So let's not make any particular choice and start pushing these two equations into the other two equations of Maxwell. That's the upper, first and last here, in order to see what comes out. Those then will be equations for phi and A. And if we could solve them, then we put the A and a phi back in here and get the fields. And that's another form of Maxwell's equations exactly equivalent to it. So we have to find the equations for A and phi. OK? So we begin. We substitute into divergence of E equals 0, equals rho. That is the divergence of E. And then I just substitute this. The divergence of the gradient is the Laplacian, at least it used to be, it still is, minus the rate of change with time of the divergence of A is equal to rho over epsilon 0. Ha, there's one of our equations already. It's not going to be hard to find them. They're a kind of a mess. Don't bother to copy them down. I'm going to do something to simplify them. Now the next equation says that the curl of B minus, if you'll let me do it this way, dE dt is equal to J. See, I'm using this equation. But I want to get all the field-dependent things on this side. And now I take the curl of B. I have to take the curl of the curl. Oh, well, all right. The C squared times the curl of A. Horrible mess. Minus the time derivative of this is the gradient of d phi dt minus the time derivative of the time derivative of A. All right? If you pay enough attention, you won't have to write it down because you can just do the same thing at home by yourself. Now, the curl of the curl, by using that famous back cab formula, we talked about this one before too. I can only do it by memorizing it. At any rate, it turns out to be the gradient of the divergence minus the Laplacian of A. We did it once before, so let's suppose we can do the same thing again. I know that's a little bit hurried, but we did it before, and the point that I'm trying to get to is the final result, not the intermediate steps. Good. All this junk, this plus this, see, I got this substituted for this. This all added together is supposed to be equal to J over epsilon naught. What a horrible set of equations. A and phi all mixed up equal rho. A and phi all mixed up equal J. Now, the thing that we're going to do is make use of our choice to separate the equations so that the equation for A and for phi are all together the same. Instead of choosing the divergence of A equals 0, we'll choose it equal to 1 over C squared d phi dt with a minus sign, I believe. Now you see what happens is that the gradient of the divergence of A and the gradient of d phi dt will disappear, because they cancel. If I did this thing right, I guess I have my sign wrong. Something else wrong? Yes, right, thank you. dE dt is to be subtracted, and I forgot to change the sign when I subtracted, so please let's do this. That's also wrong. What? All right, anyway. Yeah, right. So now I choose del dot A equal plus d phi dt times 1 over c squared. Then, I don't know, I lost the signs, okay? Forget them, we'll straighten them out at the end. This term will cancel as you figure out how to do it right. You can, you know. And in this term here, I mean, you just have to check the signs. The idea is straightforward. If you can't check the signs, you might as well hang up. Now, if you differentiate this, get 1 over c. The gradient of A is d phi dt, so the derivative of the gradient is the second derivative. And if I get all my signs right, here's what comes out. The following. It comes out this way. Laplacian phi minus 1 over c squared times the second derivative of phi with respect to t is equal to minus rho over epsilon 0. Laplacian of A minus 1 over c squared, the second derivative of A with respect to t, is equal to minus j over epsilon 0. Now, they're beautiful. They're beautiful because, first, they're nicely separated. With charge density goes phi, with current goes A. Furthermore, although this looks funny, Laplacian and dt, unroll it. Look, it's the second derivative with respect to x of phi plus the second derivative with respect to y of phi plus the second derivative with respect to z of phi, so you add t along with the rest. The c is only to get the units of time and space the same. And then, oh, you subtract two. Oh, but it's nice. This combination is equal to minus rho over epsilon 0. That's the equation. And the other equation, I won't bother to expand in this out so far. After you've got these two equations, and someday you can solve them, then after you get the a and the phi from these two, then, of course, you get the b from the curl of A and the e from minus gradient phi minus dA dt. And this is equivalent to Maxwell's equations, exactly equivalent to Maxwell's equations. Only, although these look still a little mixed up, we'll study that later, they're much simpler looking. And in fact, it has the great advantage that if you know how to solve this equation, you know how to solve this one, in the same way as we did magnetostatics by doing electrostatics for a fake problem. So we can still do that. Furthermore, you'll remember from a lecture on sound and the wave equation, or you may not remember, but you might, that an equation like this stuff equals zero is the equation of a propagating wave, and that the speed of propagation is c. So in regions where there are no longer any charges and currents even, when places in space where the currents and charges are zero, the solution of these equations is that this equals zero and that the current is equal to zero is not that phi and a equals zero. I mean, it could be. That's one solution. But another solution is that there's some phi and a which are changing in time, but as long as they move out at a speed c and that they're propagating. So you see here we have the wave equation. The wave characteristics of the electromagnetic equations are obvious from these equations. And in this form, the things are simpler in some respects than in the original form. For many practical purposes in solving physical problems and so on, we need the original forms. But we climbed up that. I am now going down the other side of the past to see those things which look different and to see if we can discover something beautiful. Well, I have put pearls before you. It's up to you what you do with them. Yeah.
And,
come here. No. No. The flux of E through a loop is the integral. The integral over a surface through the loop of the normal component of E over the surface area. That's what I mean by this flux here. It's true that divergence is the flux from an infinitesimal volume. But here we're talking about an open, a closed surface, infinitesimal closed surface is a divergence. But this is the flux through a partial surface. That is a piece that has an edge to it. And the edge is the loop. It's best thing to do, if you're worried about it, is to look at this one again. See what it means physically, drawing pictures and so on. Remember what it means. And all you see that's happened here is that the E and the B have replaced each other with some constant change. And then you'll understand what it means.
On this second equation with the Laplace.
Yeah.
Is that a C squared in the basement?
Yes.
Under the J?
Oh, yeah. Sorry, that's right. I'm sorry. It's J. No, that's correct. I made a mistake. The reason I made a mistake is I always use units where C equals 1, and I'm not used to seeing where the C's go. Okay.
That's very nice.
Yes, sir. We're right there now. It's beautiful. It's beautiful. In all the textbooks I've seen, they show you these equations and they scream about them being beautiful. What they know is that there's going to, the applications are going, yeah. But you can't see it by looking at it. It's a dirty trick to hammer on the guy and say, look, if you don't appreciate these, you're doomed. But how can you appreciate it the first time you look at it? Well, now you'll find that the phi isn't as real as you thought it was. You see, because the phi is not the energy needed to put a charge somewhere. How can it be? Because things are changing with time. How do you work that out? Do you carry it instantaneously, or do you bring it in slowly? The fields are always changing with time. So the moment they begin to change with time, the phi loses its significance, and the A never had it, and they get much more similar to each other.
Could you, just for me, go over slowly that propagation argument?
Yeah.
Just sketch it in.
Yeah, here we are. I'm only, in this argument, I'm not proving that this is the right, I'm not directly demonstrating this, but I'm showing that this is a solution, all right? And in fact, it's the only solution. I suppose that when this goes up, that there's a region in which the fields look like they look here and which moves out with a velocity v. Yeah. And in order to find that velocity, I take the two laws, the Faraday law and the other one, and it goes like this, that if I take a closed loop and I ask that the line integral of E should equal the B, the flux, the rate of change of the flux of B. The line integral of E is just E times the length. Now I need the time rate of change of the flux of B. Why does the flux of B change? B is constant, the area change. How fast is the area change? Velocity times the length, right? So there's B times the rate of change of the area. You cancel the L's and you get E equal VB. Well, this picture is a corresponding picture this way, and it was that way, you see? And you do the same thing, but the E's and the B's are reversed in the roles, and you're using the last equation instead of the other one. And so the only difference is that the C square is over here, and the B and E are reversed. So you get C squared B equal VE. I don't have to go through the drawing again. So you get C squared B equal VE, and E must be VB. And so that can only be true if V and C are the same, all right? That was just
to a packet.
That's right. That's to show you that, no, it's not a photon. No. Photon is a quantum mechanical idea. This is an electromagnetic disturbance, light, or electromagnetic wave, or a signal from a radio station, or something like that, that goes out. Of course, in this packet, the fields are constant. When a radio transmitter transmits, they take the currents and they go, and so you get fields that vary in space, as long as the thing has been turned on. When it's turned off, the fields don't disappear. They keep right on going, even though the station is turned off, flying through space, and then they're received at the other end, and they go to the antenna and so on. So it brings us right back to the...
So
theory we had before where we were discussing light.
Would you explain that? I didn't see...
What?
You had the current up on the current down and you turn it off.
No. I have a current, which is zero. At a certain time, I turn it on. I want to turn it off. How do I solve the problem? I got to solve it all over again. No. I imagine a new problem in which I had a current which I turned on at a t equals zero. And then I had, at t equals 1 hour, another current turned on, equal and opposite. All right? Now, the result, the total current, of course, is just the sum of the two, which is just on for an hour and turned off, right? But the analysis of the fields is the sum of the fields obtained from the first one and from the second one. Of course, in the end, they should be nothing, but the first one makes this bunch of fields which runs out in a, leaving, you know, leaving all the field behind. The second one makes another one on top, but it's opposite in sign, and all the fields are reversed, and so it leaves zero behind. So I have a chunk which is riding along with the front and back going at the same speed. That's what I was trying to explain. I always leave out something. I left out a phrase about the displacement current, that this term is called displacement current, and it's very bad, it's not a current at all, and it shouldn't be tried to be understood as a current. It just has that name because of Maxwell's interpretation. That's why I said something about Maxwell's interpretation, then I forgot to.
Why is the displacement bad?
Because it's not a current. This is a current, a moving charge, and this term is another term in the equation. It has been called a displacement current because in Maxwell's day it was a current of some of the guts of his machinery. But it's not a current of anything, and it's not physically like a current of moving charges. The only reason it was a current is people had the habits that they like the curl of B to be the total current for some reason. It isn't. It's equal to the current plus something else. So they call the something else a current, so they can then say it is equal to the total current, but that's just silly. It's a mistake, and it's confusing because the displacement current is not a current of charge in any sense. And so it's much, then no statement could I make that would be right. For instance, I can't say that the currents and charges completely determine the fields because I don't know, I have to find the fields in order to determine the currents according to that other definition. But I mean as real electrical charges. And the conservation of current laws changed everything. It's a mess. So just leave this as another term in the equation, just like this term is an equation, a term in equation without saying any name for it. We don't call this the magnetic current, a magnetic current or anything like that. There's no current. It's just a term. So that's why I think maybe it's just as well that I didn't say anything as to say anything. Yeah, right. Than to warn against somebody else saying something.
Because that really isn't the displacement current.
No, there is a displacement. Well, that's what Maxwell called the displacement current. There is a displacement current. He called the thing the total thing, the displacement current. So in a vacuum, this would be the displacement current. But that's a bad terminology. So maybe it's just as well I said nothing. Here,